If I could turn back time. Yes, as Cher says, if we could only turn back time, if we could just find a way. But wait, we can turn back time, because this is Playback, the only podcast with stories from the NPR archives from exactly 25 years ago. And what about time? What did it sound like in October 1983?
U.S. Naval Observatory Master Clock at the tone, Eastern Daylight Time, 13 hours, 3 minutes, 45 seconds.
Okay, so in October 1983, if you wanted to know the time exactly, you could call this guy at the Naval Observatory right next door to the Vice President's house. And no, you wouldn't reach Dick Cheney, because he didn't live next door in 1983. Is actually a guy named Marty Edwards. We'll have the full format-breaking story of the newly accessible, always accurate Master Clock. And how about that presidential race in 1983? When we turn back time, we hear talk of putting a woman on the Democratic ticket. Here's former Congresswoman Barbara Jordan grilling Democratic candidate Walter Mondale.
What are the disadvantages of having a woman as your vice presidential running mate?
None.
Good answer, Walter. We'll have all the pros and cons of feminine vice presidential charm in 1983. And right on time for Halloween, Andrei Codrescu discusses that blood-sucking rascal, Count Dracula.
I was a little reluctant to claim Dracula, that queasy product in all his post-Hollywood glory. But what the hell, he was sexy, immortal, and fun.
Those are three qualities you'd be hard-pressed to beat. We have it on good authority from NPR's only Transylvanian commentator. In reality, it was getting very scary out there. On October 23, 1983, two suicide bombers attacked American Marines and French military forces in Beirut, Lebanon. It was the single deadliest attack on Americans overseas since World War II.
About 6:20 this morning, a truck filled with high explosives crashed through the southern gate just to the north of the Beirut International Airport. Drove into the lobby of what was formerly the Aviation Safety Building and detonated.
That building was home for more than 200 American Marines. Moments after that first explosion, another truck loaded with explosives was detonated in the garage of a building housing French soldiers. Reporter Robert Fisk, who has been to the scenes of the attacks, says the rescue efforts are still underway.
At both the French headquarters and the American headquarters, they are still looking for bodies and indeed for wounded. Earlier on in the day, it was possible to hear men shouting and screaming for help and in pain within the ruins. But I gather that this evening it's a question of just trying to use tubes and oxygen bottles to push oxygen down into the ruins in case anyone is still alive, and merely the recovering of corpses. The French appear to have 26 dead, the American Marines 120. But in fact, Red Cross officials warn that this figure could well go much higher.
The death toll did go higher. 241 American Marines were killed in the blast, as well as 58 French servicemen and 6 civilians. Here's President Reagan speaking to the nation on the morning of the bombing.
I know there are no words that can express our sorrow and grief over the loss of those splendid young men and the injury to so many others. I know there are no words also that can ease the burden of grief for the families of those young men.
Mr. Reagan first received the news at about 2:30 this morning Eastern Time. He conferred almost immediately with Secretary of State Shultz, and then with the full National Security Council back in the White House Situation Room. It was not long before administration officials started suggesting that Iran may have played a part in this morning's bombing. There are, among Lebanon's many factions, fundamentalist Muslim Shiites with strong allegiance to Ayatollah Khomeini of Iran. In addition, Iran sent a contingent of Revolutionary Guards to a part of Lebanon controlled by Syria during the fighting in the summer of 1982. Today, White House spokesman Larry Speaks said there are intelligence reports that provide circumstantial evidence of Iranian involvement in this morning's explosion. Speak said the administration was not prepared to make a definite statement that Iranians were involved, stressing that the evidence is circumstantial so far. Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger was asked on ABC this afternoon whether the evidence points simply to Lebanese groups with allegiance to Iran or to the government of Iran itself.
Well, I think it's comparatively immaterial. The two are pretty much the same thing. But again, I emphasize that what I was talking about were some initial and some circumstantial factors. And some of these same circumstances were present in the bombing of the American embassy a few months ago. And there was, again, a terrible loss of life. There are other possibilities, and they're all being investigated very carefully and obviously being investigated with the idea of trying to do something about it when we can establish what we believe is the truth.
Secretary Weinberger, like other government officials, refused to talk about what actions the U.S. might take if the evidence against Iran becomes conclusive. Said Larry Speaks, "I would not want to telegraph our intentions." President Reagan is on the record as saying this: "Let terrorists be aware that when the rules of international behavior are violated, our policy will be one of swift and effective retribution." That was on January 27, 1981. Today, administration officials are insisting there will be no change in the basic mission of the U.S. Marines in the Lebanon peacekeeping force, a point that was underscored by Mr. Reagan this morning.
I think we should all recognize that these deeds make so evident the bestial nature of those who would assume power if they could have their way and drive us out of that area, that we must be more determined than ever that they cannot take over that vital and strategic area of the earth, or for that matter, any other part of the earth.
There were talks of a retaliatory strike by the United States, but ultimately none was taken, and the U.S. presence in Lebanon continued to spark debate. Here are some comments from tourists at the Washington Monument just days after the attack.
I think we should bring them back. I think we're going to get into the same thing we were in Vietnam, and I never have understood why we were there.
I don't think we can bring them back now, because we did that in Korea, and look where we wound up.
I would bring them home.
Eventually, they may need to be brought home, but this is not the time to bring them home.
And I'd help them go over there and kick some butt.
Now that they're there, it's very difficult to bring them out without indicating that we've given up on the whole process.
They're sitting ducks.
If we pull out, the Russians are going to take over, very obvious.
We should definitely bring them home, because it doesn't make any sense for us, the U.S., to be losing lives over there for a war that's going to develop that we really, at this point, should not be involved in.
If we're going to stay over there, I think we ought to try to do something while we're there, otherwise get out.
Well, if they bring them home, that'd just be saying they give up, letting the communists get their way.
To me, it's just like the involvement in Vietnam.
It's hard to justify sending our young people there to be killed, for the sake of keeping them from killing one another.
I don't know if we have enough interest to merit the lives that we've lost there right now.
We're not the people that they want there to keep the peace. That's the problem. I think they've got to use third world nations.
We believe in freedom, and we try to help the people that believe the same way we are, especially when we have the power to do so.
I say pull out. Let them have their mess.
Within 6 months of the attack, the U.S. had completely withdrawn all U.S. Marines from Lebanon. And within 3 days of the Beirut bombing, on October 26, 1983, the U.S. invaded the tiny Caribbean island of Grenada.
At approximately 5:40 a.m. Eastern Time, a force of 1,900 Army Rangers and Marines began their assault on Grenada with parachute drops and an amphibious landing. They were joined by some 300 troops from six Caribbean countries. Shortly after the attack started, the invasion force began broadcasting the news on radio.
You heard the man. Do not hinder our efforts to stabilize your nation. Now, I bet you're wondering, what the heck? Let's listen to President Reagan explain this one.
When I received reports that a large number of our citizens were seeking to escape the island, thereby exposing themselves to great danger, and after receiving a formal request for help,
a unanimous request from our neighboring states, I concluded the United States had no choice but to act strongly and decisively.
The soldiers have secured Grenada's two airports and at least one of the two areas housing students at St. George's Medical College. There's no word of any civilian casualties at this point, but it's clear there have been some very tense moments. An American student, identified as Mark, we have no last name, had to cut short a ham radio conversation with an operator in the U.S. because of gunfire around a campus building. Another American, Don Atkinson, who has lived in Grenada for 12 years, describes helicopter assaults near the second campus site.
The other campus is right down below us here, and most recently, about 10 minutes before I came on the air, there were two helicopter gunships that came along the shore and both parallel to it and then came back at right angles to it, spraying the palm trees down in the unoccupied areas adjacent to the school, and between the hotels was gunfire, and then flew on over the head of our house.
As he was speaking on ham radio, Atkinson said the roof of his house was being strafed, but he said he was calm.
Which makes me wonder, if someone was strafing my roof, I wonder if I would remain calm. And why again did we invade Grenada?
In justifying why American forces are being used tonight in Grenada, the Secretary of State described an atmosphere of violent uncertainty there following the death of that country's prime minister last Wednesday. He described a clear call for help from the other islands in the Eastern Caribbean, and he described a desire to secure the safety of the 1,000 or so Americans in Grenada, as well as to establish law and order and democracy there. Schultz stressed that the sequence of events that led to the president's decision to use force was unrelated to Lebanon and unrelated to simply wanting to demonstrate American military power or decisiveness. The secretary said the first meeting in the White House Situation Room on Grenada occurred last Thursday, the day after Prime Minister Maurice Bishop was killed. That was considered to be a grave turn of events, Schultz said, and the group recommended that a naval task force be diverted toward the island as a precautionary measure.
So it took a couple of days, well, a week to be exact, but the U.S. press corps was finally brought down to Grenada to have a look. Here's NPR's Scott Simon.
What are Americans doing on Grenada? Well, the answer now, nearly 7 days following the invasion, is virtually everything. The flight of our press pool aboard a troop carrier into the island landed at the Point Salines airstrip where American Army engineers are completing work on an airplane terminal building commenced by Cuban construction workers. Army engineers are excavating flat another area of that field onto which they will park more American airplanes. Governor General Paul Scoon, the American-designated leader of a provisional government, addressed his nation Saturday from an American military compound. And when Vice Admiral Joseph Metcalf was asked Saturday how long he anticipated American soldiers would remain in Grenada, he responded,
"I haven't got the foggiest idea, and if I did have an idea, I wouldn't tell you."
By all accounts, specifically the one of another pool of reporters escorted by the Army into the capital city of St. George's, American soldiers are being welcomed and adored by most of the Grenadian people. But the presence of 10,000 American soldiers on Grenada has created, however temporarily, what amounts to an American administration of the island, which has some aspects that could distress Americans themselves. For example, Saturday afternoon, St. George's and a Grenadian family has told American soldiers that two men they have seen driving by are soldiers in the People's Revolutionary Army of Grenada. The two men are taken from their car, frisked, and arrested. But for what, some reporters wanted to know? Being soldiers on the losing side of an invasion? Were American soldiers now making Grenadian law in the streets of St. George's? The United States is not formally at war with Cuba, and yet there are more than 600 Cubans, 400 construction workers, 200 soldiers imprisoned between blue steel rolls of barbed wire at a prison camp northeast of the airstrip at Point Salines. When our press pool was brought into the camp, we were not permitted to speak with prisoners, but did talk to its commandant, Army Captain Vaughn Peterson.
Where are the Grenadians?
Grenadians are over here.
Have you been interrogating the Cubans?
I'd rather not answer that.
Has anybody been interrogating the Cubans?
Okay, I'd rather not answer.
But we were taken to see the punctured and pitted remainders of a Russian-constructed armored personnel carrier. Eight Cuban soldiers, according to the Public Information Office, died inside of it last Tuesday, and reporters on this day poked their hands and fingers through the holes made by mortar rounds in the armor sides. Inside of the carrier, there were still shredded clothing from the Cuban soldiers, balled up by blood, rust-colored silhouettes in blood splayed along the interior walls of the vehicle. But in just a few hours' time on Grenada, in the company of, but maybe not always because of the presence of American soldiers, you acquire the idea that the arrival of the Americans, under whatever strange circumstances, has presented a new sense of welcome possibilities to many Grenadians. For National Public Radio, this is Scott Simon reporting.
I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback. So here's a bit of a date writer. On October 9th, 1983, Secretary of the Interior James Watt resigned. He had a knack for saying and doing the wrong things. From banning the Beach Boys from the July 4th concert on the Washington Mall, to decreasing funding for environmental programs, easing regulations on oil and mining companies, developing federal lands, the list goes on, topped off by this now famous remark about the racial and ethnic makeup of his coal commission.
I appointed the Lenos Commission, 5 members, 3 Democrats, 2 Republicans. Every kind of mix you can have. I have a black, I have a woman, two Jews and a cripple. And
yeehaw! What a way to go. And though James Watt might not have seen it coming, in 1983 there was serious talk about putting a woman on the Democratic ticket. Here's former Congresswoman Barbara Jordan speaking in a candidates forum to Democratic hopeful Walter Mondale.
Mr. Vice President, much has been made of the possibility of a woman running as a vice presidential candidate on the ticket. My question to you is not whether you would accept a woman as your running mate, because certainly you would. My question to you is what are the disadvantages of having a woman as your vice presidential running mate?
None.
Barbara Jordan, were you satisfied with that answer from Walter Mondale?
I was not satisfied with that answer from Walter Mondale because everybody exercising common sense knows that if a woman had been a tremendous plus on a national presidential ticket, a woman would have been on a ticket long ago. There is some disadvantage, and I think the disadvantage is that a lot of people in this country are not willing to consider a woman for an office which ranks that high. And because of that negative mindset, that can be perceived as a disadvantage, but not an insurmountable one.
What do you think the reason is for that reluctance? After all, Golda Meir has led the nation of Israel. Margaret Thatcher at the moment is leading Great Britain. Why are we lagging so?
We have been so brainwashed with the superiority of white male personalities that it is difficult to cut through that and perceive a woman as a person of competence. I think we can look at some recent history and make some conclusions about that. I certainly think we will have a woman as president of this country in the foreseeable future.
You don't think, though, that we're going to see a woman on any ticket in 1984?
I do not feel that we will see a woman on either ticket in 1984.
Susan Stamberg talking to former Congresswoman Barbara Jordan. And what did Americans think about the lady running mate thing? Here's pollster Lou Harris.
We find by 66% to 24%, a big majority of the American people favor a woman running for vice president. But even more important is just below the surface the kind of pattern of support for that idea. For the Democrats, it could well be an idea whose time has come. Traditional Democratic groups are for it much more heavily than the population as a whole. For example, blacks favor a woman vice president by 77% to 19%, Hispanics by 73% to 16%, liberals by 76% to 16%, Democrats as a whole by 68% to 25%, compared, if you will, with Republicans, who are only 58% to 29% who favor a woman. Yet there are still other groups, key swing groups, which will probably determine the outcome of what now looks to be a very close presidential election, who are also decisively in favor of a woman for vice president. The college-educated group, won by Ronald Reagan in 1980, and indeed where he's maintained a steady lead, they favor a woman for vice president by 70% to 18%. The prospect of a woman running for vice president in 1984 on the Democratic ticket ought to be taken quite seriously.
You'd be ill-advised if you did not take this lady politician thing seriously, because when we look into the future, what do we see? We see a woman as a vice presidential candidate. Yes, a dynamic woman of the people. No, not the one who can see Russia from her house, Sarah Palin, a congresswoman from New York, Geraldine Ferraro. Walter Mondale picked her in the summer of 84 to be the very first female vice presidential running mate. And if you want to know what's up with today's gender politics, you need look no further than npr.org/elections. Here's another playback fast forward.
The Environmental Protection Agency today released a report warning that the burning of fossil fuels is causing the climate of the Earth to warm up faster than expected. The EPA said this so-called greenhouse effect will begin to change global weather, agriculture, and economies as early as the 1990s. Bruce Gellerman has this report.
Since before the turn of the century, some scientists have been warning that the burning of fossil fuels would increase the amount of carbon dioxide in the air. Coal, gas, and oil all give off carbon dioxide as they burn. And scientific theory says that the carbon dioxide allows the sun's rays to penetrate to the Earth, but not escape back into space, trapping heat in our atmosphere and significantly raising the Earth's temperature. But the Environmental Protection Agency report released today is the first time the federal government officially acknowledges that the so-called greenhouse effect is more than a theoretical possibility. The report says the problem has been decades in the making and will be felt for decades to come, with major climatic changes by the mid-1990s. In the next 20 years, the average temperature on the Earth will, according to the report, increase by as much as 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit. A small change, but when viewed on a global scale, it could have profound effects, particularly on agriculture and shorelines as some polar ice melts. The EPA report asks, can we delay a greenhouse warming? Joseph Cannon of the EPA is pessimistic.
The short answer to the question, can we delay a greenhouse warming, is a very qualified, we might be able to do something almost inconsequential in the short term to change it. Over the long term, when you get out to 2100, there are things that you can do to change that, change the increment on top of that, that might be significant. But for right now, the idea of this report is to give us a feeling that something may be happening and we should be adjusting to it now. If we react as though this is a doomsday report and we ended up shutting down all fossil fuel installations, there would be little or no effect.
And speaking of little or no effect, a report was released at the end of September 2008 that shows that even with renewed awareness of global warming, man-made emissions of carbon dioxide grew to a record 2.5% last year. And if you were looking for a little comic relief in October of 1983, you could always call the U.S. Naval Observatory Master Clock, available to anyone with a phone.
U.S. Naval Observatory Master Clock. At the tone, Eastern Daylight Time, 13 hours, 3 minutes, 45 seconds.
The new number is area code 900-410-TIME, and a call costs 50 cents.
Universal time, 17 hours, 3 minutes, 50 seconds.
The master clock at the Naval Observatory is really 24 clocks. Each one keeps a slightly different pace than the others, but the difference is so small that most of us wouldn't even notice. But to timekeepers, like Gernot Winkler, the astronomer who heads the observatory's time service division, that difference is important.
If you have one clock, then of course you always believe what it says. You have no choice. If you have two, you are in trouble because you don't know which one is right. If you have three, two may agree. If you have 24, you find that quite a few of them agree. And it is a measure of consensus on which our timescale computations are based.
And that consensus is the official time, used as a reference point for government services like air traffic control and defense communications. Even this radio program is timed using the master clock. So when you look at your watch, remember, you're not only telling time, you're also pinpointing your place in the cosmos. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Richards in Washington.
And if I could pinpoint my place in the cosmos, then I guess I would have invented the GPS. But since I didn't, I've got the next best thing. A timeless story about Dracula from a man who claims the same ancestral homeland as the Count, poet Andrei Codrescu.
When I first came to America in 1966, one could live with Dracula. When asked, as I usually am, after I say where I'm from, if I knew Dracula, I would laugh. But that was in 1966. Gas was cheap. Love was in the air. The war was far away. People were rich in demons, both within and without. Those without inner demons, the unfortunates, could always look about them and see the spectral figures of state power, the riot police, the spies, the school administrations. In 1966, the demons within and the demons without balanced and supported each other. Since then, the demons without have gained. Today, we cannot properly speak of anyone's interior. There isn't any. A bronzed pair of jogging shoes and a flashing computer screen occupy the uncluttered psyche of young America. Consequently, a huge appetite for terror engages the national body in the outer world. I noticed the change in myself. In the old days, never one to concern myself with facts, I was always happy to make up mythologies for my birthplace. Sure, I was a little reluctant to claim Dracula, that queasy product in all his post-Hollywood glory. But what the hell, he was sexy, immortal, and fun. He soon became one of my closer cousins, and he got bigger. The shadow of his fangs, pervasive but tolerable as little as 10 years ago, slowly widened to encompass America. It fell over movie audiences, it tumbled out of late-night TV, it tinged with red the sexual habits of the populace. But lately, I am confining myself to an ambiguous smile. There are newer and more terrifying demons about. I now look into the eyes of the person asking me, "Where are you from?" And in there, I see a need greater than the need for old myths. I see an enormous vacuum, an imploring absence, a vast greed for surrender, and a fear for which the Drac is only a sorry palliative. We need stronger myths now, myths that can match the insanity of a life already ruled by imitation, simulation, and ventriloquism. Already nothing is what it seems. Under the beautiful forest lie 1,000 chemical drums. On creeping but swift ghost feet, Halloween is surely and slowly becoming the nation's biggest holiday.
Ah, Halloween, the nation's biggest and most festive holiday. Special playback production thanks go to Michael Katziff, Robert Speer, and the brave guys and gals of NPR's broadcast library. Next month, we witness the birth of the cell phone. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback from NPR.